Good morning, everybody. Happy Monday and happy fall. Yes, it is autumn. It is officially autumn. Also following the hopes and dreams of Memphis football fans, which we will get into today. Today on the radio show, every Monday, we do the fight song roundup, where we honor those teams that deserve to be honored. And this week we got a very colorful team that does not deserve to be honored, that's going to be blown up. So we'll do that in the fight song roundup. Chris Harrington straight up at 10 o'clock. I will tell you this, a week from today, Memphis Grizzlies media day. So we will have meat on the bones to talk about with Chris Harrington starting 1 week from today. And then a lot of NFL. It continues to be absolutely stunning what happens in the NFL on any given day. If you had the Panthers winning big on your bingo card, let's see. We had the Vikings destroying the Texans. We had the,
by the way,
Bronco.
Daniel Jones's struggles against the Vikings now, I don't think are quite as like abnormal. That's played the Vikings so far, their quarterback has looked terrible.
They made C.J. Stroud look absolutely under siege yesterday. And it's interesting because all the attention's going to Sam Darnold.
Right.
But it's that defense.
That defense is hellacious.
Absolutely hellacious. And the defensive coordinator should be getting some credit for that. Amen. As well. Anyway, Vikings win big over the Texans. That was kind of surprising. You had the Broncos defeating the Bucks. You had your Giants defeating the Browns. Maybe not that surprising, but still Daniel Jones looked good. How about this one? You had the Rams beating the 49ers in what was really a home game for the 49ers in Los Angeles. And
down 10
said,
down 10 in the second half.
Coming back to win late. And then you had the Panthers beating the Raiders. Those among the surprises. I don't think what happened in Tennessee, the result was a surprise with Green Bay humiliating Tennessee. But the way it happened, the Malik Willis revenge game, that was certainly humiliating. So we do have a lot to talk about in the NFL. Two games tonight in the NFL, including my beloved Buffalo Bills playing Jacksonville. I, of course, am convinced the Bills will lose. But that's the lineup. We got the fight song roundup. We got Chris Harrington. We got the NFL to talk about. I wrote a column about the Grizzlies and this gun referendum that you should read over at the Daily Memphian. We'll talk about that at some point as well. But we'll start with the deflating, absolutely deflating effort by the Memphis Tigers Saturday, as they are lose a horrific defensive performance. Putrid was the word I settled on. A putrid defensive performance in losing to Navy 56-44. And Jeffrey, you know, we talked about this as a trap game, as a classic trap game. Honestly, I don't think it was about the trap. You know, I think it was just like the defense had no clue. It was as if you had taken those defensive players and thrown them out there, didn't know anything about what Navy was about, didn't know each other, like nothing. The way that Blake Horvath, 6 touchdowns, more than 400 yards of offense. Navy had 8 plays of 20. Every time you looked, turn around, you just couldn't believe it. There was another long gain. 8 plays of 20 or more yards, 4 plays of 40 or more yards. It was absolutely, absolutely depressing as hell. And obviously, and we'll get into it, Memphis had the opportunity late. Seth throws the pick, game over. But the story of this one was the defense getting absolutely riddled. And Ryan Silverfield said afterwards, "It's been a long time since I've seen that lack of execution on one side of the ball." And he's coached this defense, a team that has had a lousy defense for years now, but says it's been a long time since I've seen that lack of execution on one side of the ball. Your thoughts?
So I was trying to figure out, it's like, where did this game go wrong? Because I actually thought, if you would have told me, hey, they're going to lose, I would have thought they would have come out kind of sleepy. And the thing that was fascinating to me is they come out, that first drive, like it was surgical. Moved up and down the field. And then they forced the three and out. And so I'm thinking, oh, this is the perfect game script for them. They're going to go down and score again.
And then it went wrong on the kick return then.
Yeah.
But that's when it went wrong, because then it was 14 all at that point, right? And then the screwed up totally could have been worse than it was.
They're lucky they kept the ball, honestly. Right. Right.
And exactly. Then they end up punting from the four, I think they were punting. Yeah. And then they go down 21-14. And then that was after that, it was like all she wrote. And Memphis scores to make it 21-17. I think they get a field goal. Well, you can't get a field goal. And
no, that
like,
was a touchdowns game.
There's only a couple of minutes left. What's Navy going to do? What's Navy's going to do is run right down to go down the field again. Like every time they needed to, sometimes when you play Navy, it's like this relentless grinding 6 yards, like that. You don't know where they are. There's 8 yards a run. There's 6 yards a run. There's, you know, another 6 yards, another 8 yards. And they're just slowly grinding it down the field averaging 5 runs a pop or some 7 runs a pop, maybe even 7 yards a pop. This wasn't that. This was Horvath, 12 carries, 211 rushing yards. This was 20 yards a pop. It was truly embarrassing. And it was astounding because the one thing we thought we knew was, or we thought we'd learned from Florida State and from the first few games of the season, was this was a different kind of Memphis defense. Well, different, not better, at least against this.
I mean, Florida State won a game this week. They still only scored 14 points.
Yeah, Florida State wins. Florida State beats Cal. But it was not an offense. 220 yards or something like that, a total offense, or 240 Florida State had. They did nothing offensively. And so you had Memphis, and I guess, you know, Seth was upfront about the pick. It wasn't, you know, he ran the wrong route or whatever. He just said he didn't expect the defensive back to do what he did.
Oh, there's nothing worse than that feeling either, too. It's like right when you release it, right when you let it go, you're like, oh, S.
And so that was that. But when you have a 300-yard quarterback, a quarterback throw for 300 yards, two running backs run for 100 yards, and two receivers catch balls for 100 yards, and more than 650 yards of offense, you expect to win. And so you can't really blame the offense here. It felt like miraculously somehow they might come back to win that game. Perfectly executed onside kick. But in the end,
it was also, I'll say this though. I'm not obviously putting this loss on the offense, but I did feel like watching the game, this was a game where Seth's numbers looked better than he played.
I can see that.
Because like I just felt like he was off for a large portion of the day, especially given the fact that Navy did not generate a lot of pressure. Like Seth was able to kind of go through his reads and whatnot. I thought he was just off throwing the ball.
So here we have a situation where, obviously, you know, literally a week ago, I was writing a column saying that Florida State win could, depending on what happened next, could be, you know, one of the biggest wins in Memphis football history. Well, what happened next was utterly deflating. Literally last week, we had the win over Florida State. We had the clear path to the playoff. And then we had all of this talk about realignment and however that would work out. Within it, at least, within the conversation, was a universal acknowledgement that Memphis is the most appealing, most compelling group of five school out there. And that's who, of course, the Pac-12 would want. And so there was, Memphis was basking in positive attention for once from the national media. And so you have all of that happening, which is why we knew emotionally this was a trap game for all of us, because when you get your, you know, when you're finally allowed to feel really good about things as a Memphis sports fan, you sort of are waiting for the other cleat to drop. And it did. And so then the question is everything, you know, is everything gone? Is it dead? Is it whatever? And listen, no, technically, I mean, the year that Memphis went to the Cotton Bowl, they lost to Temple.
Yes.
You know, like there is a chance that if they win every game from here on out, they will still be the Group of Five representative. It is not dead. The reason that I think it's particularly deflating, in addition to the timing, is twofold. One is, it's not dead, but there are certainly circumstances under which, even if they win every game, they may not, you know, they may not be the Group of Five representative, because there are other teams out there, including James Madison, which just hung 70 on North Carolina. But as you pointed out, Jeffrey, if you look around, like how many weeks ago that were people were saying, well, they'll never catch Northern Illinois.
Right.
Northern Illinois has that win over Notre Dame. Well, Northern Illinois goes and loses to Buffalo, which you called, by the way. Good call. Toledo, another one. Toledo gets the big win over Mississippi State. How are you going to, you're never going to catch Toledo? Well, Toledo goes out and loses to Western Kentucky.
Yeah.
So there are, Boise plays Washington State this coming week. Like, teams lose games.
Well, Boise's going to play UNLV, and one of them has to win.
One of them has to lose. But teams lose games. It doesn't mean that everything is over forever and ever and ever. There's still a chance, of course. It's a little iffy, and it's even a little iffy in conference, because obviously, just take Navy right off the bat. Now Navy's got to lose two games. Like, they have the tiebreaker over you, right? Navy has the tiebreaker over you. And by the way, Army's out there. Army's 2-0 in conference. They beat Rice this weekend. They do not play Tulane. They do not play South Florida. And they do not play Memphis. Army does not play Memphis, Tulane, or South Florida, and is right now undefeated. So even within the conference, there is now work to be done, very clearly. And looking nationally, it's honestly at this point, you just put your head down and you hope in 6 weeks you can look up and you're relevant again. You did not get a single vote in either top 25 poll, nor should you have at this point. And so I'm not saying that those dreams are over forever. Invariably, it's, you know, you're not dead, but it feels like you should just put them over to the side for a while. Because, and that gets me to the other question, the other reason, more than just what can technically happen, is how good are you? You know, if you're going to go in and give up 56 points to Navy, and obviously you don't play another offense like Navy, but does Memphis look like a team that's going to, you know, run the table the rest of the way? Or I think you could easily, and I'm not predicting this one way or another, you could easily look up and Memphis has lost three games by the end of the regular season, right? Easily. Right. I mean,
yeah,
they got to play Tulane on the road. They got to play South Florida. South Florida got absolutely taken apart, but Miami's really good. You got to play Tulane on the road. You got to play South Florida on the road. You got to play UTSA on the road. And by the way, this was a game that you were supposed to win. No one had this one circled as an L. And those are the ones that people did have circled as maybe L's. And you lost one that wasn't circled. And now you have the ones that are circled yet to come. So there is just a hell of a lot of work to be done.
Yeah, the big story is you no longer have a mulligan. Like, if you're talking about,
clearly,
you know, can this team still be a playoff team? Yes. I also think it's helpful, even though they'll always say recency bias doesn't matter, it clearly helps that if you lose your game, it happens in September. And then if you can rip off, you know, whatever, the next nine straight.
I mean, the way that works, yes. The way that works is, if you can lose a game, if you know for sure you're only going to lose one game, go ahead and lose it in September.
Correct.
Sometimes losing a game in September is portent of the fact that you're going to lose games.
Correct.
In October and November. That's what usually happens. Most teams that lose games in September also lose them in October and November.
Right.
And so, but given if we're going to stipulate that they're only going to lose one, which is obviously the hope here, then yes, I think you're right. You can lose it early. Who, by the way, do you think is right now to say they're even the arrival suggests that Memphis's arrival. Memphis has sort of disappeared from the picture. But right now, who do you think is the favorite in the group of five? Who would you put your money on? You have to pick someone.
So I know the story of the week will be JMU. I've just watched enough Sunbelt to know that that league is so similar for the same reasons. Like, I really wasn't all that concerned about Northern right. Illinois, whatnot. Like, that league is very similar. And so it's very difficult.
But isn't it? App State sucks this year.
They Coastal look very bad.
Coastal isn't the same as the, you know, this year. Is it a watered down conference? Is it the same? No one's going to get through that. Going to get out alive that it usually is.
I mean, Lafayette still looks pretty good. I mean, that's the thing about that league. And then they're going to start playing games, you know, on weird dates, and then weird results start to happen. Like when they start playing Tuesdays and Wednesdays. And that's kind of like when you get into some of these, like, man, how did that happen?
So you're not picking James Madison is not your choice.
No, right now I'm leaning towards whoever wins the Mountain West. But like, that's the other thing. The Mountain West, you can tell me Boise beats or UNLV beats Boise in the regular season, and then Boise has two losses, but they win the conference title.
Conference title game.
And then so if Memphis is sitting there at 12-1 as a conference champion, like, I think they're going to have the edge.
Last point on this. Do you chalk this defensive performance up to Navy just completely confused them, and it's a one-off because it's Navy. They will not play Navy again, but they still have – or do you think, well, the defense really isn't as good as we were hoping it was?
I think – little column A, little column B, but if I'm having to say that it's one or the other, I actually think this was Navy playing like out of its mind. Like, I was wildly impressed. Yes, there were plays where it looked like Memphis was nowhere near the ball, but I also think that Navy came out, they had a game plan they hadn't shown, they had several plays that Memphis just wasn't prepared for because Navy had only played two games and had a bye week. Like, Navy unloaded the clip.
Navy had played cupcakes and had shown nothing.
Correct.
Right? And this is a new Navy offense. And so if you want to make excuses for Memphis or explanations for Memphis, either one, whatever you want to call them, it's partly like they hadn't seen any of this. Sure, they know the triple option, but they were throwing the kitchen sink at them. It was very clear. Very clear.
But to sit there and act like, so if you take out that last possession where Navy was trying to shorten the clock, you know, like they were just trying to get Memphis to use their timeouts and in the game, they had 9 possessions and 7 went for touchdowns.
That's staggering stuff, man. That is staggering stuff. Okay. So that then gets us to the conference realignment stuff. And I think we can all agree, Jeffrey, this loss will have no impact on good news. This loss, even that last stat, 7 touchdowns in 9 drives, will have no impact on conference realignment. All the reporting on conference realignment seems to be conversations continue and the conversations are about the kinds of things that one would imagine them to be. You know, that they're about. Here, I'll read Dan Wolfen's latest tweet on this. Memphis, which some consider the linchpin of Pac-12 expansion plans, is asking for a whole lot in negotiations. Memphis exploring some football-only scenarios. Memphis may or may not be overplaying its hand, depending on who you talk to. Now, there's a may or may not be. One person close to negotiations characterized Pac-12's AAC rate as 50-50 chance of success. Pac-12 not having any real numbers other than a spreadsheet from Navigate is an impediment. You think? I love that.
For those that don't know, Navigate is the media consultant that they're working with.
Yeah. So there you go. Nicole Auerbach says, as always, as others have reported, this should be a week that gives us realignment clarity. The Mountain West also working on having its remaining members essentially recommit. As always with realignment, there's a fear of inaction. My sense from sources is that the AAC schools are being patient and deliberate and talking to each other. They're weighing the risks. This is the same as the Navigate thing. There's a great deal of skepticism within the industry about the Pac-12, its consultant projecting $10 to $15 million per school in a media rights deal that doesn't exist yet. And the AAC exit fees would be significant. Who pays them? So in the end, like I've been saying all along from the very beginning, my preference, if it literally came down to you just get to pick, what group of schools would you rather be with? My preference would be the new Pac-12. But I think the phrase I've used from the beginning is it's a math problem. And so, of course, what matters here is what are the rights fees? Who's going to pay the rights fees? What's the projected television revenue? And what's the level of certainty around the television revenue? So I don't blame the university at all. If it overplaying its hand, I don't believe blame the university at all for being careful with this decision. And hell, if they have some leverage here, if they're the belle of the ball, they should be being careful and they should be asking for as much as possible. In the end, if the money doesn't add up, the money doesn't add up. Like if the rights fees are too high, if the TV revenue feels too speculative, well, then you can't in good conscience go. If that is the way that it works out, though, that they don't go because the money didn't work, it will be the right decision. It will still be a deflating decision. You know, you're not staying because you like the AAC or because the AAC seems more compelling or because you like the football lineup of home games that you have now. You're staying because you don't believe in what the better thing that was offered. And so you have to stay with the thing that you have, right? Like it's in the end, to use the lifeboat analogy, you looked in the new lifeboat and you think you're getting in a new lifeboat. And then you look in the way back of the lifeboat and you realize there's a giant ass hole being covered up by a piece of cardboard. And you're like, oh, this isn't a better lifeboat ever. It doesn't make your lifeboat any more stable. If in the end you don't get into that other lifeboat, it doesn't mean that your lifeboat is suddenly terrific. It just means the one that you thought was coming along isn't a better lifeboat. And that's what they're doing. They're sizing up all this stuff because in the end, it's a math problem. Your thoughts, Jeffrey?
I think there's several things here. Number one, I totally agree with you. If indeed the report is accurate, in which Memphis is the linchpin, as it was been referred to, of this whole thing, why wouldn't Memphis try to get the best deal for themselves? It's a negotiation. Like that, the fact that people are offended that somehow Memphis would be negotiating on its behalf is kind of insane to me. Of course, that's the way that it is. I guess the only other thing that I would point out is, what if it's a math problem now, but it becomes a bigger math problem down the line? Because one thing that appears to be true to me right now, the AAC has a better deal financially than it will have, in my opinion, the next time. And so, yes, maybe
isn't there even a look-in at the – doesn't the AAC – don't they have a right to in 2 years? Is there not a look-in for the AAC? I think you're right. Like this idea that the
AAC – I'll say this. I don't remember exactly when the date is. I know ESPN in all of their deals puts a look-in to renegotiate. And, again, I know that people feel a certain way about Mike Oresko, and I'm certainly not defending him as a perfect conference commissioner. But one thing I do think he doesn't get enough credit for was he kept that deal at the same rate when really they had lost a ton of value. And so it's one of those things where I think everyone's doing the math thinking this is just the numbers, like this is what the deal's always going to be. And it's like, no, you're kind of right now operating on a deal that you probably don't deserve. Or if you took it to market, I'm not sure you'd get.
Well, then, but the other question is, who is they? In other words, that might be, listen, I don't know Ed Scott. You know, I know we had him on the air once and he was terrific, right? And I don't know President Hargrave particularly. I've talked to him over the years since he's arrived. And I'll be honest, some of the ways in which the University of Memphis has, like if you look back at the stuff, the state money, the Grizzlies negotiations, they were damn effective with the way they did that. Like, you know what I mean? Like they negotiated. I don't think, I don't think it was honestly always in the best interest of the city of Memphis, but it was in the best interest of the University of Memphis. And I think that is mostly their obligation. And they were very savvy in the way they did that. And so I don't have any, I think what you say is absolutely true, that the AAC deal is not going to remain what it is. And it's a crap conference now. They know that. Like they know that. I don't know if everyone listening to us knows that, and I'm glad you brought it up, but I'm sure Bill Hardgrave knows that, and I'm sure Ed Scott knows that, and so there are all these things they are weighing. I also don't think I'm not saying that I'm confident they will make the right decision, because some of the right decision is, who knows how it will play out. We don't know how it will play out. Will that money, the Pac-12 money, turned out to be real, or will it turn out to be fake, or, you know, who knows?
Like, I mean, it seems to me at a certain point, like, this would be the other thing I'd say, you know, whether or not it's negotiation, whatnot. I also think Memphis knows it's best for them if they can kind of stall a little bit. The more that they can stall, like, they'll have closer to, like, more information if they take their time. And to your point, I think that's what makes this decision so hard, is it seems likely at this point you're going to have to probably make a decision with either speculative information or incomplete information.
Yes, it will 100% be incomplete, because you are not going to have a signed TV contract, right? So it will be, at some point, their best judgment of what will happen in the future. And that is scary. And so I, for one, am glad they're being meticulous and careful as they think about the right thing to do here. The football only thing, Jeffrey, where does that come from? What would that look like? That one hit yesterday. I had not heard it before.
I mean, I think honestly, that one to me seems obvious, in that you're concerned about travel with everyone else.
For everyone else, that's right. You don't want sending your softball team all over the place, so it's just football team. And then the other thing, a part of that is that multiple people have reported that South Florida seems unlikely to go. And so if South Florida would have been a more eastern partner, if you were trying to cut down on travel, right? You go with Tulane, you go with South Florida, and you build some sort of division which cuts down on travel. I think that's right. That would be, we're happy to send our football team, plays a much shorter schedule.
Right. We're talking about four travel games a year. Yeah.
We're happy to do that, but we don't want to send our softball team up and down the West Coast, and we don't want to send our golfers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's where all of that is, or our best sense is that they are, and I'll bet, like, I've had talked to various fans over the weekend whose mood rises and falls depending on how likely they think this is, right? And, oh, is Memphis blowing it? Or, oh my God, you know, particularly with the over the hand stuff. And I guess maybe it's misplaced confidence, but I have some confidence in the people who are doing this to survey the other option, the options, and pick the best one. I'll tell you again, if the one they pick is to stay in the AAC, that will be deflating, because it's very clear they don't want to stay in the AAC. No one thinks the AAC is a great option. What the choice to stay in the AAC would simply mean, we don't think there's a better option. So that will be the result that would be kind of depressing, but it doesn't mean it would be the wrong result. It could still be the right result, the right decision for the leadership to make, but also be deflating.
I also think, I mean, I know how, and I'm not, this is not a criticism of, this is the way that it works. Like, it's also possible that we think in real time they made the right decision, and then we'll look back in 5 years either way, and you
That's
go,
true.
You know what I mean? Like, it's because this all comes back to, they're going to have to make a decision with incomplete information.
And they're going to have to sign away their rights for,
right,
you know, whatever, a 5-year period. And so then the world around them will change. It's every decision we make, you know, it's about, if you decide to buy a new house, you're buying a house and you're buying a house, thinking about what we think is going to happen to the neighborhood.
Exactly.
Right. Or whatever else. Like, and in the end, maybe the neighborhoods, or maybe all of a sudden the neighborhoods becomes the hot neighborhood in the city, whatever else.
Right.
You make decisions based on the information in front of you. It can turn out to be the wrong decision, or it can turn out to be an unfortunate decision. But that's where we are. I am a little bit, I think it's too bad. You got MTSU, obviously, this weekend. That's a 6:30 game.
Some have said the perfect antidote for a bad week.
I guess it's the perfect antidote. And I think people will go. I think they'll have a better crowd than they did in week two. It's later in the day. People get a little juiced up. Get over it, whatever. Get over the Navy thing. But it's too bad that you won't have, you know, it doesn't feel like you're going to have an influx of 5,000 to 8,000 people who think they're on the trail of a playoff berth. That certainly does not feel like what will be happening when MTSU comes to town. But they obviously need to sell tickets. So if you're so inclined, go ahead and buy you one. All right, we're going to do the fight song roundup when we come back. We also have Chris Harrington to talk to, and then we got the NFL and a whole lot of other stuff. If you're selling your house, call Josh Issa. You might have heard last week that the Fed, Charles likes to tell us about this, the Fed lowered interest rates. So mortgage rates are coming down, have been coming down. Honestly, this is a great time to sell or to buy a home. Ashley heard me talking about Josh Issa on the radio. Call Josh Issa, and within a week, full asking price. Yep. I'm not saying that will happen if you call Josh Issa, but I am saying you should give him a try. 901-461-8147, 901-461-8147. Flexible fees, no upfront costs, let you out of your contract at any time. He's got more than 300 five-star Google reviews. It's Josh Issa, 901-461-8147, or joshhasthebuyers.com. Go see Josh and his team at Keller Williams Realty today. Back in a moment. Jeff Calkins, 92.9 FM ESPN. All right, back on the Jeff Calkins Show. Let's do the fight song roundup. All right, Jeffrey, who are we starting with?
Jeff, the Tennessee Vols.
Tennessee Vols roll into Oklahoma and emerge with the victory 25-15. I got a stat for you, Jeffrey.
All right.
Josh Heupel loses his first three games against ranked opponents. In his last 15, 10-5 against ranked opponents. The previous four coaches from 2009 to 2020 at Tennessee were 9-47. This was one that you said in making your picks last week, like, what's the catch here? You know, yes. Like, this is honestly what we now expect of Tennessee, which is saying something. It is Josh Heupel has transformed this team. And obviously this was a suffocating defensive performance, some of which had to do with Jackson Arnold's ineffectiveness. But listen, they get a safety. They force three turnovers, 11 tackles for loss. This is it was a suffocating defensive performance by Tennessee. And it's kind of what you've come to expect. Tennessee is a legit, not just playoff contender. Tennessee is a legit national championship contender, no?
Yeah, part of Oklahoma's offensive struggles, yeah, Arnold was not playing well, but the big part of it was Tennessee's defensive line was just absolutely eating Oklahoma's lunch all day. And the thing that struck me about this game was kind of how it was a mature win. Like, when Heupel realized, hey, if we don't do anything to beat ourselves, we're going to be fine here. So let's kind of throttle it down offensively. They never really got the run game going big time, but they did enough with Nico making a big throw, whatnot. And then after that, it was just like, let's put this in the hands of our defense. And their defense was just ready and waiting for the call.
Yeah, Nico, 13-21, 194. He had the strip sacks, obviously. He had the 66-yard touchdown pass to Thornton.
He also had a big play called back, but I mean, I thought he played within himself. Yeah, he had a couple of like mistakes on the strip sacks, but like he never really put the ball in jeopardy. And I thought he played well, especially considering his first real road start.
You had the second quarter by that Tennessee defense, five possessions. So Oklahoma had five possessions. In those five possessions in the second quarter, there was not a single positive play. Total of negative 20 yards, two turnovers, and a safety. I mean, that was
and a turnover on downs.
Yeah, it was just unbelievable. It was as unbelievable as Navy's offensive effectiveness, seven touchdowns in nine drives against Memphis was. It was like, holy crap, am I watching this? Now, some of this, again, Jackson Arnold, and it is kind of remarkable when you realize that Oklahoma encouraged Dylan Gabriel to leave with his 30 touchdowns and 3,660 yards, encouraged him to find a new home for Jackson Arnold. And now Jackson Arnold is pulled for Hawkins. And so they have an issue there, obviously, on their hands at Oklahoma. But I think the way you put it is exactly right. A mature win. And we still haven't seen the secondary tested.
Yeah.
You know?
Totally
and,
agree.
And someday we will. Like that's the question at this point with Tennessee. But I think they are they're not just a clearly a contender for the playoffs. They are a contender for the national championship. All right, let's play the next. There it is, Jeffrey. There was a time when I despaired as to whether we would hear the best fight song in all the land played this year. But sure enough, there it is, 200 and what a Michigan fashion, too. Beating USC 27-24, 290 yards rushing. Hang on to win to get the winning touchdown with 41 seconds left. Mullings was unbelievable. The run to set it up was the one that was unbelievable. That was crazy. 63-yard run, spinning out of tackles. I think he has very clearly emerged as the best running back at Michigan. And they didn't have to pass. Passing, who needs to pass? Jeffrey, you don't need to pass. 32 yards passing, and they win anyway. Miller Moss put up nice numbers. And honestly, if you're USC, I don't think you have to feel sick about this. I guess you do because you played pretty well and whatever, but you still got chances. They are a tougher USC team, right? I mean, I think it is a tougher USC team than we have seen previously. Miller Moss is still good. That was just the most Michigan performance ever, and Michigan gets the win.
I think what we saw with Michigan is they have – figured out what their formula is. Like, I mean, they're essentially a glorified option team. Like, they are just going to run it. They don't need to throw it. I think the other stat is, like, if you combine Harbaugh in the last 3 years, I think it's games where they've thrown for under 100 yards, they're 6-0, and then this would put them 7-0.
Yeah.
I did think, though, this was a game script game. And to me, it's like, if I'm USC, I'm not disheartened. But the game did go exactly how Michigan needed it to go.
Yes. I think you're right. If they play this 10 times, I would pick USC 6 or 7.
And really, this – I don't want to put it on
– 6 was huge.
That's what I'm saying. Like, I don't want to put it on Miller Moss's shoulders because I thought the guy played his ass off. Like, and he was under duress all night. And also, shout out to Woody Marks, former Mississippi State guy. That guy can play for me. But – that game really just rolled down to – it came down to the pick six. And USC, which I think has done a much better job on defense and they're tackling much better, they picked a bad time to have their worst possession on defense.
Oh, yeah. that was certainly a highlight film of a run. Anyway, Michigan wins. So lost season is not all that lost as they get the win at the Big House over USC. Who's next?
We definitely had to get this one.
Yeah, a brand new fight song. Always good to have a brand new fight song. We've been doing this for years now. And so when you can break out a brand new fight song, thrilled to do it. James Madison 70, UNC 50. James Madison scored 53 points in the first half. That is the most ever allowed by UNC in a half. And by the way, this is a James Madison team that played Gardner Webb earlier this year. James Madison beat Gardner Webb 13-6, and they hung 70 on North Carolina. Alonzo Barnett the third, 7 touchdowns for James Madison. Accounts for 7 touchdowns for James Madison. Just kind of extraordinary beatdown. The first half, James Madison forces 4 turnovers. Block punt for a touchdown and a pick six. That's how you score 53 points. You can't do it just going up and down the field. No, block punt for a touchdown, pick six, 4 first half turnovers. And this is here's the astounding thing about James Madison. Kurt Cignetti obviously heads off to Indiana. He's the new coach in Indiana.
And they're rolling too.
And they're rolling too. But you're like, oh, that's tough. You lose Kurt Cignetti. Not only do you lose Kurt Cignetti, he takes 13 players with him. And you think, Jeffrey, they're the worst players, or do you think they're the best players?
Probably the best ones.
I would think they're the best players. James Madison has 64 new players, plus Bob Chesney, of course, the new coach. 64 new players, and they hung 70 on North Carolina. By the way, between North Carolina, NC State, and App State, not a basketball season cannot get here soon enough for that state. But anyway, and then it does, like Mac Brown supposedly told the team afterwards, if I'm the problem, I'll step down, whatever. This feels like it's going that direction. But shout out to James Madison. Jeffrey doesn't believe that James Madison will be the Group of Five representative just because the conference is too tough.
The Sun Belt just kind of does this where
too unpredictable.
Like they'll have big wins, but it's too many similar teams.
All right, let's play, Jeffrey. Play these next two back-to-back because okay. I want to get to the team that we're going to blow up. Play the next two back-to-back. We'll let it air out for a minute, and then I'll say a few words, and then we'll move on to the blow-up team. Two songs we are playing, of course, Colorado and Florida State. Florida State, because God bless Mike Norvell for finally getting the win. I would not say it was persuasive, but it was a win. Florida State beats Cal, so that was good. And don't look now, Colorado hanging in there, 3-1. Colorado 3-1 with a Shedeur Sanders Hail Mary to tie, and then Travis Hunter. We said you can watch Colorado for those two players alone. Travis Hunter for Heisman, Jeffrey. Travis Hunter, 7 catches, 130 yards, and forces the goal line fumble in overtime to clinch the win. Anything to say particularly about those two efforts?
The Baylor +2 is a loss that's going to stick with me forever. It's like Arkansas with the Oklahoma State loss.
That's brutal.
That one's going to stick with me.
That's brutal. You lose on the Hail Mary. Oh.
Not only the Hail Mary, it was first and goal when Hunter forces the fumble. If he just goes down, they're still going to score. And I think they were going to go for two, and whether or not they make the two or not, like I still win. That was a brutal one. That was tough.
That's murderous. We actually have a bunch of other schools we could honor here, and I'll just mention some of them in passing. Obviously, Miami eviscerates USF. Cam Ward for Heisman. There's another one. Clemson continues to roll after the early beatdown by Georgia. Turns out maybe it's just Georgia's really good, 34-3, but then they rebound, and this time it was 59-35 over NC.
It wasn't that close. That was a lot of garbage time.
They had, Clemson has scored 45 or more in the first half in the last two games. So maybe that just tells you how good Georgia is. Utah with a big win.
Yeah, over with Oklahoma a backup quarterback. State,
with a backup quarterback, Michael Bernard, with 182 yards rushing there. They had to rush the ball a bunch. BYU, you didn't see this one coming, comes, kicks Kansas's ass. Absolutely destroys Kansas. And by the way, if you look at those teams that are new to the Big 12, Cincinnati was 3-9 last year. They just beat Houston 34-0. And honestly, they should be 4-0, except for they blew that game against Pitt, right?
Yep.
They got USF coming up next. BYU, obviously finding its way. SMU beat the hell out of TCU.
So much so that Sonny Dykes had to get tossed.
Sonny Dykes gets ejected there. Anyone else? Oh, Utah. We haven't mentioned Illinois.
Yeah.
Illinois with the big win over Nebraska.
I have not seen 3rd and 42 in an overtime period.
So there's a bunch. But I want to get to the team that we want to. I know you want to get to the team that we're going to blow up. Mm-hmm. So we'll do that now. That's a really fine fight song to blow up, I'll be honest. It's a really great fight song to blow up. But I do think, and I felt bad because we should be honoring Arkansas as well. Arkansas gets the win over Auburn 24-14.
God, you want to talk about teams that could be 4-0. Jeez.
Oh, there's another one. Absolutely right. This is, by the way, it was 48-10 last year. And so good for Arkansas for getting its revenge. But Auburn has a problem, and this time Hugh Freeze switches quarterbacks, goes to Hank Brown, 3 first half picks, switches back to Peyton Thorne. He throws a pick, and afterwards, do we have the audio, Jeffrey? We don't. Here's Hugh Freeze, putting it all on himself. So, Jeffrey, I'll be honest. Over the years, as you've been quite so hard on Hugh Freeze, I've wondered if you go a little overboard. But I have to say, he immediately comes out and throws his quarterbacks under the bus, and then Bo Wallace, of course, who played for him at Ole Miss, then takes to Twitter and absolutely lights up his old head coach, says, among other things, we're approaching the point that he's thrown so many QBs under the bus that maybe no one wants to play for him. His offense helped me tremendously put up numbers when I blew my shoulder out, but why is it someone else's always fault when there's a loss? When there's a win, I watch the press conferences just to count how many times the word I is used. Appreciate his did what he did for me. My son wouldn't be playing for him, though. On and on and on. That dude has never helped me a day in his life. It was always only about getting a win for him so he could collect his 100 racks a win, et cetera, et cetera. And then he went back and forth and back and forth, just blistering Hugh Freeze. Your thoughts?
Yeah, he also went on Neil's postgame show afterwards on like late Saturday night. So that's available on YouTube if you want to go watch that.
Yeah.
That was
said much the same thing. The same kind of thing.
Yeah, much the same thing. We kind of swap stories, and I mean, this is kind of the thing about Freeze. What I never had understood was there was this weird reality around him where you weren't able to criticize him, and it's like this is the ultimate, like, it's sports. You can always criticize coaching, but it was like if you ever criticized him, all of a sudden you were like a hater or you hated Christians. It was all these things that like I would get and it was like, this is bizarre. But if you presented another point of view about him, he like there was just always this attack, attack, attack. And what's fascinating to me now is, yeah, Bo was very vocal on Saturday. But you're now starting to see more former players come out and kind of say similar type things. And, you know, at the end of the day, he could have chosen to go and get a new quarterback. He didn't do it. Like, and, you know, when you put the ball in the air, like, yeah, interceptions can happen. And the other thing is, it's like, Jarquez Hunter's a great running back. Why is he only getting 12 carries? Like, that game, it wasn't like that game was, like, out of hand. It was largely a one-score game most of the way. It's like, I don't know, maybe feed the good running back.
Well, in the end, there's two things here. One, on the quarterback stuff, of course, Hugh Freeze is right. You do need a quarterback who's not going to throw it to the other team, but this is the same thing we say with Penny, same thing we say with every coach, you know, in the country, in college football and basketball, you pick the players. So if you don't have a quarterback who can't throw, doesn't throw it to the other team, that's because you didn't find a quarterback who doesn't throw it to the other team. That's you. Honestly, it's almost a bigger indictment than if you called the wrong play. You know what I mean?
For like, sure.
Your job is to find players. Indeed, one of the reasons that Hugh Freeze was hired was because he has a reputation as a great recruiter. So literally, that's the job. And so you think you're running over your quarterback. You're really just running over yourself because you're the one who, and honestly, with Peyton Thorne, you had him last year. Like, it's not like you know what he is. And so,
he's like ruining mentally two quarterbacks.
Yes. So then there's the separate thing about the job that he's doing is one thing. And then, the schism between former players and Hugh Freeze is quite another. And that seems to me to be a hell of an indictment when Bo Wallace comes out there and just... Now, sometimes, I don't know, like, does Bo Wallace have some axe to grind? Like, occasionally you'll see a former Memphis Tiger come out and you'll know that they're criticizing Memphis because they thought they were going to be handed a job and they weren't handed a job or whatever else. Like, there's people can have other reasons for lighting someone up. Is there any, like, is there something to that with Bo? Does Bo have a reason to light Hugh up that isn't, you know, isn't football related?
I think much of it for Bo stems back to Bo believes good Bo, bad Bo narrative was formed entirely by Hugh. Every time that Ole Miss would lose a game, you know, he would throw
bad Bo.
It was bad Bo, and it was Bo's fault. I mean, I think that's a lot of what it is. And then Bo pointed out, he's like, you know, I jacked up my shoulder. He's like, you have no idea how many injections I had to take just to play. And, you know, there was never any like, hey, thank you for what you did or whatnot. I mean, I think that like it's a pure good versus evil? Probably not. But at the same time, it's like, I know whose side I'm taking.
Yeah. All right, we got to take a break. Chris Harrington coming up next. We got a lot of other things to talk about, including a Grizzly Story column that I wrote today. We'll get to that in the second hour and a full NFL slate. Before then, I will tell you, if you are looking to have something framed, head on into the Frame Corner. You can buy a frame, of course, but what they're really great at is custom framing, and they can take memories. They can take your grandfather's arrowheads. They can take a fishing lure connection. They can take your wedding photos. They can take sports memorabilia, and they can make it absolutely beautiful and make it a piece that will last forever. It's 5035 Park Avenue's Frame Corner, framecornermemphis.com, 5035 Park Avenue. Chris Harrington next. It's Jeff Gawkins Show, 92.9 FM ESPN. All right, back on the Jeff Gawkins Show. Let's do this Chris Harrington deal. Chris Hanna joins me now. Chris, what are we listening to?
That is a then 19-year-old Donna Rhodes doing a particularly down home cover of the Motown classic "Baby I Need Your Lovin'" at Sam Phillips Recording in 1969, around the time she became part of the vocal trio Rhodes Chalmers Rhodes, which backed up Al Green and all of his hits, among many other things. They're going into the Memphis Music Hall of Fame this Friday. I did a big story about them today.
Yeah, fascinating piece in the Daily Memphian. I urge people to read it. I have tweeted it out. I want to talk about it just a little bit because I had no idea about this. So at the beginning of the song Let's Stay Together, the first voices you hear are Rhodes, Chalmers, and Rhodes, who are three white singers who are the backup singers to Al Green. And you sort of wrote about how that came to pass. So walk me through it just a little bit. Sandra and Donna Rhodes, they grew up. I, the whole thing, I read it this morning in the early morning hours. They grew up, their dad was a country, had a country radio show, and they moved here from Missouri, and they sort of grew up as show business kids in the world of country. And then you got Charles Chalmers, who grew up, I guess, was a saxophone player. He was an instrumentalist in many ways. He's from Southside High School. They were from Bartlett High School. How did this happen to come together?
Well, you know, the Memphis music scene in that era was really a hothouse. There was stuff going on everywhere, studios all over town. People were, you know, musicians, and people were working in between different studios, working in different spheres of activity, going back and forth between Memphis and Muscle Shoals, Alabama. It was almost sort of like a little, like, satellite version of Memphis that was popping off at the same time. And there was just a lot of overlap and a lot of creativity across studios, across genres, across people. And, like, all kinds of stuff happened sort of in that era. You know, it's how, you know, Jim Stewart, the country fiddle player, ends up, you know, devising the greatest Southern soul label at Stax and many other things like that. And so they were working in all kinds of different ways. They were writing songs, they were recording demos, they were, you know, different versions of them were playing on other people's records, they were singing on other people's records, they were arranging horns on other people's records. They were all three involved in all this different stuff. But the origin of the trio, there's some difference of memory a little bit about this. I led with Let's Stay Together because that's like the song everybody knows. I don't think that's even like the best song, and certainly not the first that they did, but that's the one everybody knows. But Charlie Chalmers was a longtime collaborator with Willie Mitchell at Royal Studios, who was the producer who did all the Al Green stuff, playing horns, doing horn charts and horn arrangements and stuff like that. So he was in studio with Willie because he was always in studio with Willie. Willie was looking for some backup singers. He knew that Charlie Chalmers had been working with the Rhodes sisters on some demos and said, "Hey, bring those girls over. Think they could sing on this?" And he said yes and brought them over. And they started working with that. And Willie Mitchell decided the vocal sound didn't have enough meat in it. It needed to fatten up a little bit. And asked Charlie Chalmers, who had never sung on a recording before, maybe on demos, but never on a recording, was not known as a singer, told him to, like, go into the studio and join them and let's see what that sounds like. And then it goes from there. And they ended up, you know, being the backup vocalist on all the Al Green records, but all the Ann Peebles records and all the high studio soul records. Ended up going down to Muscle Shoals and doing sessions, you know, sang backup on all kinds of, like, number one hits in the 70s. Ended up on a Liza Minnelli record, on a Frank Sinatra record, going to Miami with the Bee Gees, all kinds of stuff.
It's interesting, by the way. So, like, I, of course, I'm even just reading these, because I know vaguely about something about Stax. I watched a documentary. I've lived in Memphis for a while now. But, like, there's Stax, and then there's Royal Studios, and there's High Records, and all these artists are collaborating or whatnot. The story, by the way, I love the quote from Willie Mitchell. He said, at least according to, I guess this is according to Chalmers in your piece, he said, right, "It ain't got no meat." That's great. So you bring in Chalmers to sing on it as well. Was that on Tired of Being Alone? Was that on the first song? Was that on Tired of Being Alone?
That is Charles Chalmers' memory. That is the most familiar version of the story that's been told, to the degree it's been told. I actually think, like, this story may be the longest, like, piece written about them. There's not a ton of stuff out there. I mean, I have a library full of Memphis music books, and, you know, I start pouring through indexes, and there's, like, three paragraphs in this book, and it, there's not a lot out there. But that is, that's a version of the story that was told in the liner notes to an Al Green box set about 15 years ago, and that's the best version I was able to get in reporting this time, too.
So, and then it is amazing. They then worked, they did the Bee Gees, you said. They worked with the Bee Gees. They did Hooked on a Feeling, which those of my contemporaries from the 70s will remember. Having My Baby, is that Paul Anka? They were having your baby.
Often considered one of the worst records ever, but it was the number one hit.
That's right. Having Your Baby. I mean, it's that was 70s stuff, really. So here's the other question, because I like that you asked them about this too. Obviously talented singers, and I think the way you phrase it is no one sets out to be a backup singer, right? That, you know, right. And here they are, I guess they're both alive, and all three of them are alive and well. In fact, one of the Rhodes sisters married Charles Chalmers and then subsequently divorced, I guess. But I imagine they're all going to be there. How do they feel about being backup singers as opposed to having, you know, had their own being? Maybe there were other paths that could have led them to stardom.
Yeah, I think Charles Chalmers was fine about it because he was always going to be a sideman backup guy. Like, you know, he was never going to be a lead artist on anything. I mean, he did put out one record on his own, but that was in an era where all these people were putting out these sort of instrumental, like, you know, albums that were sort of very of the era. He was never going to be, like, the guy up front of anything.
Right.
He was always going to be a, you know, songwriter, session player, arranger, all of that. He was a studio guy. I think the Rhodes sisters, there were paths not taken. They put out a record with Chet Atkins when they were teenagers. And they had a lot of backing behind them in Nashville. And they had a chance to have a career as a country music duo out front. But they were teenagers, and that's not where they were. That's not where they were. By the time their record came out, that's not the music they were listening to anymore. They were listening to WDIA. And so it just didn't fit who they thought they were. It was probably a bad decision commercially, but it's not where they were. And they both put out solo records in the late 60s, early 70s. The Donna Rhodes one, I think, is particularly good. And it's just like a typical Memphis music, you know, vagaries of the music business thing, you know, bad decisions, bad backing, bad luck. It just didn't take off. But, you know, in the annals of, like, people, everyone who's ever had a career in music, like, they've had a pretty great one. You know, they've done all this stuff. They traveled all over the world. They're going into the Memphis Music Hall of Fame. They've had careers. You know, we're talking about them on the radio. That's further along than 99.9% of people who go into music get, right?
Yeah. I urge people to read the story, fascinating story, over at the Daily Memphian, which I have tweeted out. Also read at the Daily Memphian that you went to, you're in town, you're back in town, and you went to this new restaurant called Overland, which is a Montana sort of themed restaurant. Before I ask you about the restaurant, have you seen Yellowstone? Is that a show you've watched?
I have not. Though my mother asks me about it every time I talk to her. But I still have not watched Yellowstone.
She's an avid watcher. She's a fan.
She is. She has the DVDs.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I watched the first episode or something like that. Anyway, so you went to Overland, which has things like bison and elk and whatnot. Where is Overland and how is Overland?
It is in the fifth floor of a hotel on the Thornwood development, which is Germantown Road, sort of, I'm going to get my directions messed up. Germantown Road in Neshoba by Germantown Performing Arts Center. That's probably the best I can do. And, you know, that's a big development that's been sort of growing over the last decade or so. And this is in the fifth floor, top floor of a hotel there. And it is, I would say, quasi-Western themed. The decor is very Western themed. And the menu is sort of partial. Like, it's a lot of just basic stuff you would find at an upscale American restaurant. You know, you can get a filet, get a Caesar salad, get a salmon, whatever. Not a lot of salmon in middle Montana, I don't think. But it does have some dishes that do have that connected back to that. The rack of elk is what I wrote about that I recommended. There's also a bison ribeye that was not available the night I went. I went to one of the sneak preview nights. Not everything on the menu was available. And it was good. Pretty much not everything, but most things we had were good. And I thought the elk was particularly good. Peach cobbler was particularly good. And the main sort of angle I wrote about it was the idea of like the theme and how like what's distinctive about it is what's most interesting about it, and ended up being what was best about it. And my hope would be that, you know, it leans more in that direction. But that depends on like what the customers want. So do the customers want to go in and order elk and bison, or do they just want the filet and the salmon, you know?
I see. How is elk? What would you I don't believe I've ever eaten elk.
I don't know if I have either. I think that maybe that's the first time I've had elk. It was not gamey at all, really. It was similar to a lamb chop visually. It was a very red meat, but lean and tender and a little sweet. Had a nice gastrique on it. I thought it was quite good. I would have amped up the flavor a little bit more on the grits and the corn mash that was on top of. But the elk itself was very, very flavorful, very good. I would definitely order that.
Well, and it's right out there by GPAC too, so you can imagine that folks will, you know, swing
well,
by.
Well, they've got a balcony. I mean, there's a street, and the balcony actually looks over Neshoba Street, but it's kind of looks over towards the GPAC Grove, like their outdoor space amphitheater. So I can imagine, like, in a nice night when the weather's nice and there's like music playing over there, that'd be a pretty good vibe. Yeah.
All right, Grizzlies have media day a week from today, and so a week from now we'll have a lot of basketball to talk about. But in the spirit of Rhodes, Chalmers, and Rhodes, the Grizzlies' backup singers this year, what do you see as the strengths and the weaknesses of the bench, of the backup singers? Like, what can you count on? What do you feel good about? What are the question marks?
I mean, I feel like these next few years. Obviously, there's the question of Jaren and re-signing Jaren. But if we assume, and it doesn't matter for this year, he's there. They're all there this year. So your question is more about this year, but I'm thinking this year and a little bit beyond. If they're able to keep Jaren, Bane, Ja together, you know, through this middle stretch of their careers, the real inflection point, and part of it's like how great is Ja going to be, an MVP level player or whatever. But in terms of the second line of players, to me, there's a real pivot point on this young trio of Zach Edey, Vince Williams Jr., Gigi Jackson, sort of the second layer there. You know, Marcus Smart is the veterans, Marcus Smart, Luke Kennard, Brandon Clark. I think we sort of know what they are. But to me, those other three, and for this season, I think particularly Zach Edey and Vince Williams, they're really sort of the pivot point. Like, I think if those two players are everything they can reasonably be, like that could, the Grizzlies could have a really, really big season. And if those two players who have, you know, combined to play something like 60 NBA games, like struggle and can't play the roles the team needs them to play, it could be a slog. So I think Zach Edey and Vince Williams, their ability to play physical basketball, to rebound in particular, to score efficiently and to fit in as sort of secondary players is going to be hugely important for the Grizzlies.
What's interesting there, that makes complete sense to me. It also means, Brandon Clark and Santi Aldama were once, I mean, of course, Brandon Clark, even when he was drafted, both those guys, even when they were drafted, were older players, right? They were older. But, like, they've become, they're in the group almost, not, you know, with a Marcus Smart, whatever. They're I guess Santi's different. We don't really know
what Santi's sort of in a category by himself to me. But Brandon Clark and Marcus Smart are in the same sort of pocket to me.
And do you think that those players are therefore also, A, we know what they are, but they're also more likely to move on? You know, I mean, you know, they're more likely to, because of salary, because of whatever, they're ultimately more likely to move on. I mean, Luke Kennard is a 1-year deal. He's definitely more likely to move on. But all of them, right?
No, when you're thinking about the roster and like where the commitment is in the roster, there's a three-player tier at the top, and then there's a three-player tier below them, and then you have these other guys. And so, I think that's true long-term. But even this year, like, you know, if there ended up being some trade in the middle of the season of some consequence, like the player moving out is much more likely to be Marcus Smart or Luke Kennard or Brandon Clark than it is to be Zach Edey or Vince Williams or Gigi Jackson.
And then the three who are the pivot point, and Gigi, I guess, less so this year, even before the injury, he was less so because he was whatever. We thought he was sort of the 10th guy on the team, as highly touted as he was, as skilled as he is. But now, certainly with the injury, it's more of a
second half of the season question with GG.
Yeah, but in terms of those three, they also sort of have the highest, like you can imagine, like the highest ceilings. Gigi has the highest ceiling, but the lowest floor of those three, right? I mean, Zach is the most important in terms of that he'd be decent of those three. How would you characterize each of those three individually?
I think Zach Edey is sort of essential. I mean, for the Grizzlies' upside this season, they can get by without that, but I think they if everyone else is healthy, but A, they don't have a lot of. They're not super deep in terms of numbers up in the front court still. And then Zach Edey gives them something they otherwise don't have. And we saw it last year. There are some night, I think Domantas Sabonis averaged 25 rebounds a game against the Grizzlies last year. I think that role that he has been brought in to play, no one else is going to play it. And I think it's crucial to the team. You know, there's enough on the wing. I mean, Marcus Smart probably will end up starting. You had other guys. Right. And so the Vince Williams thing is not as crucial. But I think if he is everything he can be, that sort of 3-and-D glue guy, Kentavious Caldwell-Pope kind of role, you know, that's the kind of guy you need, especially if you get going deep into the playoffs. The guy who can guard whoever on the other team and can knock down shots and can just soak up minutes and does not hurt you on either end against any matchup. You know, I think that guy is really important.
I take it. You have real confidence that Vince Williams will be what you think he can be. Zach Edey is, just because we literally have never seen it, less confidence, right? I mean, not that you're not confident, but Vince Williams, I've sensed in you, like, well, you're pretty certain.
I believe in generally what I've seen of Vince Williams. That said, A, he hasn't played that much. There is always that. But on top of that, B, there's the question, is there a durability question? I'm not saying there is a durability issue, but is there one? You know, the game seen this late last season, like how much of that was real and how much of that was like we're in tank mode. So I think there's a question on there. And then shooting's always a question. You don't.
Right.
Good shooters can have bad shooting stretches, but we don't know how real his shooting is.
Interesting.
The defense and muscle, I believe it, you know.
Thank you, Chris. I urge people to read the piece. It's fascinating on Rhodes, Chalmers, and Rhodes. I have tweeted it out. It's over at the Daily Memphis. Thanks, Chris. Talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks.
This year, how about this? FanDuel is giving you a chance to win big every Thursday night with FanDuel Squares. Same Super Bowl Squares game that you've always played, always known. You know that one. But this one's even better because your numbers aren't just randomly assigned. You get to pick them yourself, pick as many as you like. And you get to see the odds beforehand, and you can bet them live during the game. So what are you waiting for? Go to FanDuel.com/Calkins. That's the promo code, C-A-L-K-I-N-S, C-A-L-K-I-N-S, and bet on Squares. Plus, if you're new to FanDuel, you get $200 in bonus bets guaranteed when you place your first $5 bet. Must be 21 or older. Present Tennessee, first online meal, real money wager only, $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued is non-withdrawable, but bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem, call Tennessee Redline, 1-800-889-9789. So before we take a break and talk about the NFL, Jeffrey, I did want to talk a little bit about this column that I wrote while we're on the topic of the Grizzlies in the Daily Memphian today. And we have pretty much, Jeffrey, have we talked much about this gun? We have. With Sam, we've talked about this gun referendum, right? The fact that the city council, and it feels like it's decided, because it doesn't, I think I read over the weekend that they're not appealing. So there's going to be a three-part gun referendum on the ballot this November. And it's purely symbolic, because there's state law that takes precedence here. It is not a referendum. There are actual there are three different changes to the gun laws, but it really has the effect of a referendum because they literally cannot. They're purely symbolic at this point. It's purely to send a message that people in Memphis want to have control over their own gun laws. Whatever you think about that, and I think it's pretty clear that. Like no one's coming and taking your guns. But it's pretty clear that if you look at the numbers of gun deaths since the gun laws were loosened in the state of Tennessee, it's not it's not really arguable. In 2011, 948 gun deaths in the state of Tennessee. 2021, 1,569. Gun thefts in Memphis and Nashville have increased 500% since 2011. That's when basically the gun laws started to be loosened. It's pretty clear what has happened here. But I'm not talking about that. In fact, I'm sort of on the other side of this. Not about the gun laws, but what's happened is that when it became clear that the city council wanted to have this referendum, the folks in Nashville, the Republicans in Nashville, Cameron Sexton, who's the House Speaker, et cetera, said that they would punish Memphis by not giving Memphis its sales tax money. And there's a lot of questions as to whether that would be legal, not legal, whatever else. But here's the other thing, and this is why I wrote the column. Right now, we haven't written or talked to really mentioned much about the new lease that they're trying to negotiate for the Grizzlies between the city and the county and the Grizzlies, because they're sort of quietly working towards a new memorandum of understanding. I guess they've made pretty good progress, whatever else. But the Grizzlies very clearly don't want to lock themselves into an arena if downtown's going to be a battle zone, right?
Yeah.
That's very pretty clear. So they want some insurances, and they want to sort of, they're willing to take the lead, is my understanding, on helping to make downtown a safer, more comfortable place for everyone. After concerts, after Grizzlies games, and for people who live there or visit there or come for any reason. And so my understanding is, and Sam Hardiman wrote about this and reported it, that because the mayor confirmed that part of the ask to the state legislature this year is going to be a significant amount of money for increased downtown security. Sam had a story yesterday, the Daily Memphian, about some of the things that they plan to do downtown and about this ask that is forthcoming for downtown and downtown safety. And here's the thing. If the state doesn't want to give Memphis money or wants to punish Memphis money, Memphis because of the gun referendum, who's to say they're going to say, sure, Grizzlies, we will give you this. We will give you this cash. Indeed, J.B. Smiley, who was on Behind the Headlines, the TV show Behind the Headlines, he had said that that Mayor Young, quote, heard early on that we're going to be punished. And then on the radio, on the TV show, Smiley went on to say, I don't believe in being punished by a person who puts pants on the way I do. They can't punish. Basically, that's sort of who are they to punish us, blah, 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 like that. Right. Like, who are I and stick up for Memphis and screw you, state government. And, you know, we need control. And by the way, I do believe that. I believe that we do need control over our gun laws. I do believe that it's insane the way we have focused purely on bail issues and not on the root cause of this, which is gun issues. But whatever. I think it's kind of crazy to be risking the future of the Grizzlies in Memphis over something that is purely symbolic and is just taking Nashville off. In the end, Nashville has the power here. And in the end, in the same way you needed the money from Nashville for the Liberty Bowl, the same way you needed the money to actually to fix up FedEx Forum, you're going to need the state money if you want the Grizzlies to commit to a long-term lease. And J.B. Smiley said, quote, I have no doubts the Grizzlies will get what they need. Maybe. Like, maybe. I would suggest that's the next sort of big pivot point in all this. Will the Grizzlies have assurances that downtown is safe and that they have what they need in terms of support from the state and making it safe? Smiley went on to say this. This is on the TV show Behind the Headlines again. Why is he so confident? that the Grizzlies will get their money. This is what he said. That's not an ask directly from the city of Memphis. It's different when J.B. Smiley or Mayor Young goes to have a conversation with the speaker. When they see us, they don't see their equals. They see folks who should be subservient to them. But when Jason Wexler of the Grizzlies or FedEx or Richard Smith goes or Pitt Hyde, the Howd Foundation goes, it's something completely different. I have no doubt the Grizzlies will get what they need. Now, I hope he's right. I hope he's right. I hope that when it is the Grizzlies asking or the Hyde Foundation asking, or who would he tick off, FedEx, Richard Smith, et cetera, I hope he's right. It also seems to me to be a little almost irresponsible to be saying, listen, I can say whatever I want and take as many shots, which, by the way, I think are often justified at the state government, because there's going to be no consequences, because I know these other guys are going to cover for me. I know they're going to be able to, I mean, if you listen to, it's very clearly between Cameron Sexton and J.B. Smiley, they're taking shots at each other all the time. And I just don't see how it's productive, honestly. I just don't see how it's productive. And I think it's now incumbent on the folks that the names that he rattled off, to make sure this happens anyway. But do I think that Nashville isn't capable of being small enough or petty enough or vindictive enough to withhold this money when they have already threatened to withhold a sales tax money? No, I don't think it's completely clear that they're not going to be that small or petty or vindictive. They have proven to be that in many ways in the way they deal with Memphis. And so, you know, hopefully it'll be fine. Hopefully it'll be fine. I just wish we didn't have this. And obviously, the Grizzlies aren't the most important thing, but they are an important thing. And I just don't see the point of risking that. I think it's kind of a dangerous game to be risking that over a referendum that is purely symbolic, even though I believe in the spirit of it. Jeffrey, did you have any other thoughts on that? I just wanted to get it. People can read the column over at the Daily Memphian. I've tweeted it out.
No, well, you nailed it for me. About. It's like,
all right, we'll take a break. We'll come back and we will talk about the NFL. Crazy, yet another crazy week in the NFL when we return. It's the Jeff Calkins Show, 92.9 FM ESPN. Hey, it's fall. Yep, it's fall. So I've been telling you about if you go to O'Call, you can get these polo shirts that are in NCAA approved collegiate colors, Tiger Blue, Tennessee Orange. You're going to be wearing that one proudly now. Alabama, Arkansas, Ole Miss. Go in there and get the, but let's be honest, it's fall now. We're turning the page. Same thing in quarter zips and hoodies. That's right. Same thing in quarter zips and hoodies. Could be a glorious fall for Tennessee, for example. You're going to be wearing orange, but not necessarily. Don't want a big old logo on there. And so get in there and get your fall, your quarter zips and your hoodies in the same collegiate, official collegiate colors as the same lightweight performance shirts you could up until now. By the way, it's also another reason. Fall's a great time to shop. Fall's, you know, outerwear, sweaters, beautiful clothes, incredibly helpful people. Head on in and see our friends at O'Call. All right, Jeffrey, we got the NFL to talk about. We don't have much time. What is the single thing that stuck out to you yesterday?
I think it's that the Vikings are, like, for real good.
Yeah, I think the single thing that stuck out to me was just how many things stuck out to me. Like, it feels like, and maybe it's like this every year, but it feels like the things we know, we just don't know. Like, and you know, it's kind of crazy that the Vikings blasted the Texans, that the Broncos beat the Bucks, the Giants look pretty good in beating the Browns. The Panthers, for heaven's sakes, beat the Raiders. You had the Rams beating the 49ers. The 49ers are now 1-2. Here's some teams that are 1-2. Miami's 1-2. Baltimore's 1-2. Dallas is 1-2. San Francisco's 1-2. The Rams are 1-2. Cleveland is 1-2. Those are all teams that are, I don't know, like maybe you thought Cleveland was going to be, but you didn't think Baltimore, Dallas, and San Francisco were going to be all 1-2. I think the whole thing has been just kind of nuts. But you may be right. The most significant thing, is always the Cowboys because it's the Cowboys. We'll get to them in a minute, right?
Yeah.
But I think you're right. The most significant thing might well have been the Vikings absolutely taking care of the Texans. By the way, Stephon Diggs, while he was in Buffalo, this is my favorite stat, never lost a game by as many points as they lost yesterday, as they did yesterday. Not once his entire time that he was in Buffalo. CJ Stroud, 2 picks, 4 sacks. They had, at one point, they have 3rd and 4 at the Minnesota 25, and they get 4 straight pre-snap penalties.
Yeah.
Like, they had no idea. Laremy Tunsil, who you're always talking about, is this, he is, he's an all-pro left tackle. He had 3 false starts.
And like, he had, like, the false starts, I think, were, he also had, like, the alignment penalty that we've been seeing called.
Yeah, he had 2 false starts, I think, and an alignment penalty. Yeah, he had 3.
But I think those are related. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I think the alignment is because he was worried about, you know, getting off the football.
Yeah. They ended, on that 3rd and 4 from the Miami 25, they had ultimately ended up having to punt. So, I don't think C.J. Stroud isn't good. And I don't think the Texans aren't good. I think Texans are good, and I think C.J. Stroud is good. I think the Vikings just destroyed them.
Yeah, I mean, like, it wasn't even – it was one of those games also that, like, the Texans got the ball right before the half, and you kind of talked yourself into, okay, maybe if they can score here. But it's like the Vikings have basically controlled all 3 games they've played. And, yes, like, the Giants are not a good team, but we think the Niners are a good team, and we think the Texans are a good team, and they've controlled that. They have the best point margin of any team that's 3-0.
All right, so we believe the Vikings are good. Do we believe the Cowboys are bad?
Bad? No.
Not bad.
I just don't. I think they're just kind of a wild card team.
Well, they just so clearly have this flaw.
Yeah, they really cannot stop the run,
and they gave up 143 rushing yards to Green Bay last year in the playoffs. They gave up 190 yards to the Saints last week, and then they just gave up 274 yards to the Ravens. They have given up 557 yards rushing, 5.4 yards a crack, 8 touchdowns over 3 games on the ground. You can't in the end compete. Like, you cannot be taken seriously if anyone can just line up and run the ball down your throat. Derrick Henry, 25 for 151. And afterwards, Jerry Jones was asked. It was funny to me. One of the most striking things to me is Jerry Jones is in there explaining why they can't afford Derrick Henry.
Yeah.
Right. Which maybe they could have, maybe they couldn't have. Had they signed, you know, CeeDee Lamb and Dak earlier and worked, I don't know whether they would have had money to sign Derrick Henry. Maybe they could have. To me, what's interesting is like, and Steve White, God bless his soul, who was with us for so long and was so great on the radio and such a great Memphian, he was so disgusted by the Cowboys at the end. But just the fact that it's like most GMs don't talk after. Even if you say that Jerry Jones is a GM, that's why he's talking. GMs don't talk after games.
No.
You know, like, it's just crazy how it's all about Jerry. And I do think it's to their detriment.
No, but I mean, like, that's, you know what I mean? Like, that's also probably why the Cowboys are kind of what they are. Like, I don't know. I mean, to me, I was also really disappointed in CeeDee Lamb. Like, I think, remember when we were talking about...
You can't lose that ball. That's terrible.
But, like, remember when we were talking about this summer, like, would you pay him? And I was like, I don't know, man. I leaned towards no. And it kind of crystallized with me yesterday. When there's, like, traffic and you have to make the tough catch, CeeDee, just more times than not, does not make the tough catch.
Yeah, I can see that, too. And as for the Ravens, I mean, they had to win, and they did win. And in the end, Lamar, you know, did the things they needed to do.
They shuffled their offensive line again,
so they could run out the clock and they didn't blow the big lead. Right.
Yeah.
But I don't know how persuaded I was by it, you know, but we'll see. I was persuaded by Andy Dalton. How about that? Like, that was just unbelievably great. The first quarterback this year
so
to throw for 300 yards with 3 touchdowns is Andy Dalton.
Correct.
Crazy. And by the way, Bengals next. They play the Bengals next. And so he gets a revenge game. TD touchdown on their opening series, ending their streak at 20 games of not scoring a touchdown on the opening series. They also ended their streak of 7 games without leading at any point. If you're Bryce Young, you got to feel like an idiot.
It was a tough look, and granted, like the Raiders are probably a lot better matchup than what he would have had in weeks 1 and 2. But the fact that like they came out there and you immediately were like, oh, this looks like an NFL team. This doesn't look like, you know, a team that's like
right.
essentially a glorified scout team. It like I'm now wondering, like, is he for sure going to have like a job after this? Like, I guess someone will give
He'll
him
have
a shot.
Job. But it may be a practice squad. I mean, ultimately, maybe a third quarterback, or he will have a job. I mean, look at the backup quarterbacks there. And like, hell, who did the Dolphins turn to last?
Tad Boyle.
The Dolphins turned Todd Boyle. That was tough.
Ted Tyler Boyle, Johnson. I think maybe.
Tim Boyle.
Tim Boyle, whatever. Close enough.
Tyler Huntley, it will be next, I think, because they took him off. I think they took him off of the.
He was the emergency yesterday.
Squad
yeah.
For the Ravens. He was the emergency squad. Yeah, quarterback yesterday.
They look cooked.
I don't know. In terms of who felt bad yesterday, Titans fans, I mean, the Raider fans have to feel bad. Like, this is the franchise that lost to Jeff Saturday's Colts. Like, in terms of recent ignominious losses, you know, to get beaten like that by the Panthers, you can put that up on the bookcase right alongside the loss to Jeff Saturday and those Colts, right? Remember that?
Yes, for sure.
But I think if you're a Titans fan, for Malik Willis to beat you, throw for 200 yards.
And look as competent as he has.
And then Levis, another pick six, 3 turnovers. He's got 8 on the season. Good for a bunch of yards, but 2 more interceptions. Like, what do you do there?
I mean, you got to move on. But the question is, like, at what point do you move on? Like, is it worth trying to salvage the season? Like,
yes, because the losses aren't bad. No, who cares?
Like, to me, I think the thing that's depressing is you were so convinced that Tannehill was the thing holding you back, and now it's like, God, what would you give to have Ryan Tannehill as your quarterback?
I mean, I do think with the Titans, you just think, you know what, let's get some draft picks, right?
Let's get some draft picks.
Of course you keep playing Will Levis. Why would you not, right? Same thing with the Giants. They're going to keep playing Daniel Jones. Now, the Giants have owe $30 million next year or something like that. Like, the Giants, but Daniel Jones, I'll tell you what, if you're throwing a Malik Nabers,
I mean, that's the other thing about Daniel. It's like, outside of week 1 against the Vikings, and now knowing what we know about the Vikings, Daniels looked completely fine.
That's true.
I mean, last week they should be 2-1 if they have a kicker.
Here's the problem. What happened? Quarterbacks are so confusing now because you give up on Will Levis. I mean, okay, we know Sam Darnold is being reclaimed. We know Baker Mayfield has been reclaimed. We know not his best game yesterday. We know Geno has been reclaimed. By the way, there's another undefeated team. That's not necessarily one you would have predicted. And now Justin Fields, I'm not saying I'm not saying that the jury's in, but the Bears, I think, made the right decision to move on from Justin Fields and draft Caleb Williams. Caleb Williams, 2 picks yesterday, but whatever. I'm not giving up on Caleb Williams. But now Justin Fields, he's 25 of 32, 245 yards. He actually looked competent, 78% completion percentage. He does not get a lot of help from his offensive line, and that was easily his best game.
This
so
is
like
wh- this
you
is
move on
said
from
all-
a quarterback, and all of a sudden, hey, they look competent somewhere else.
I mean, this is why I said all summer he would be the guy that I would play if I were the Steelers.
And they won't. By the way, Calvin Austin with a touchdown in that one. Nice to see. And they clearly will not move on from him now. You don't, as the great Crash Davis said, you do not mess with a streak. And so as long as he keeps winning, they will 100% keep playing Justin Fields. Don't you believe that? But
yes.
As soon as if he looks bad in a loss, that's when they. I don't rule out seeing Russell Wilson.
Yeah. No, I think so, too. But I mean, as long as he keeps playing like this, he's their quarterback.
All right, that music seems to be indicating that it is time for us to move along, make way for Jason and John. What is coming up next on 92.9?
Here's what's coming next on Jason and John. Gabe Kuhn will join them during hour number three. Heard with me today on Jeffrey Wright and Company. Also, Jason Munns will join us. Cobb will join Gabe at 5 o'clock.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Back tomorrow for Now Work Is Done.